Scripture, which is the text of the message today, comes from the book of Jeremiah, reading in the 6th chapter, verses 13 through 15. For from the east, from the least to the greatest of them, everyone is greedy for unjust gain. And from prophet to priest, everyone deals falsely. They have healed the wound of my people lightly, saying, "Peace, peace," when there is no peace. Were they ashamed when they committed abomination? No, they were not at all ashamed. They did not know how to blush. Therefore, they shall fall among those who fall. At the time I punish them, they shall be overthrown, says the Lord. I had a stewardship message all ready to go today, and one person last week said, I don't know why you get up there and go on, you should just tell the people to tithe. And so that's the stewardship message today, please tithe. He probably would want me to take the please out of there, so the stewardship message today is tithe. The message today might have a very strange sounding title, "Where Have You Gone, Joe DiMaggio?" But it really came about this week, and I pushed that stewardship sermon aside because I have received a number of telephone calls, and I have been in quite a few conversations. I have been listening to the radio and to the television. I've been reading magazines such as Sports Illustrated and the evening newspaper all about Magic Johnson. Now, unless you've been in a coma or have been exploring the outer reaches of our solar system, then you know that Magic Johnson called a news conference. He announced his retirement from the NBA, the National Basketball Association. The reason giving was that during a routine insurance examination, he tested positive for the HIV virus, which in effect causes AIDS. He says that he acquired this virus from heterosexual encounters. Quoting from this morning's paper, The Enquirer, an article written by David Anderson entitled "Magic More Hedonistic Than Hero," he quotes Magic as saying, in Sports Illustrated, "I am certain that I was infected by having unprotected sex with a woman who had the virus. The problem is I can't pinpoint the time, the place, or the woman. It's a matter of numbers," he says. "Before I was married, I truly lived the bachelor's life. I'm no Will Chamberlain, but as I traveled around the NBA cities, I was never at a loss for female companionship." While insisting that he has never had a homosexual relationship, never, he writes that his sex life in Los Angeles before his September 14th marriage wasn't any different than it was on the road trips with the Lakers. There were just some bachelors that almost every woman in Los Angeles wanted to be with. I confess that after I arrived in Los Angeles in 1979, I did my best to accommodate as many women as I could, most of them through unprotected sex. The end of the article has these words. Johnson writes that having contracted the HIV virus is God's way of directing him, well, quote, God's way of directing him to carry the message about the danger of AIDS to everyone. Johnson says, "Everything I have done, God has directed me." And David Anderson concludes by saying, "Not quite everything, as Johnson knows too well now." Now, the reason why obvious that this really hit the shockwave in the sports arena, but it's also, I think, sent a shockwave out throughout the United States, is because here we have several things all rolled up in one. We have a premier athlete, we have an athlete who's still in his prime, and athletes kind of have an aura about them that they are seemingly invincible. And so here's this person that has all of these things about him, and he comes down with the HIV virus, which is going to cause AIDS. Now, he says, we have every reason to believe that it was not from a homosexual relationship, and it was not contracted by a contaminated needle, but it was through a promiscuous heterosexual lifestyle. Now, when I first started hearing all of this about Magic Johnson, I started thinking about sports. My first thoughts were about sports and how sports have become such an integral part of our American society. If you travel other places in the world, you'll know that other societies also cling on to this thing we call sports. But here in America, we have a special section in the daily newspaper called sports. We have a special segment on the local TV news every night, which is called sports. We have a sports update throughout the day on radio. And this time of year, Saturday and Sunday, it is wall-to-wall sports. I mean, you name your sports, it's on television. And the cable has one channel that's devoted to nothing else except sports. And if you want to really know how people take sports very serious, you should tune in sometime to some sports talk show on the radio at night. Now, the question that I raise is, what is our fascination for sports? Why has sports become such an integral part of our society? Well, if you push aside the obvious reasons, because they're exciting, because they're fun to be around, to take part in, and also probably because they're a great diversion. Well, things are just so complicated in the world, and things are kind of crowding in on us. It's kind of nice. It's a diversion to go and watch some sporting activity. Now, when you push the obvious aside, I think that the reason why sports is so close to all of us is because it's a microcosm of life itself. Here we have on a playing field, whether it be a baseball diamond, a tennis court, or a football grid, here we have players who are struggling to overcome the opposition. And in life, that's what we are trying to do, whether it's an opposing team or the game itself. Here we have in sports, you have penalties for breaking the rules, which we have in life. We have people who commit errors, who cause turnovers, who make bogeys. Here we have great plays. Here we have obstacles to overcome. And here we have winners and losers. And to the player or to the team who works the hardest and does the best, this is the people or the person who gets the trophy. So for an afternoon or an evening, the drama of life is enacted before our eyes, and we can boo, and we can hiss, we can cheer, and we can scream, and we can feel a part of all of this. Now, not only is sports such an integral part of our society today and of our lives, out of sports come some of our greatest heroes. When I was a boy growing up and sitting with my father there in Crosley Field, I watched my heroes play many days. Ted Kluszewski, this has taken me back some time, but Ted Kluszewski and Wally Post and Johnny Temple, these names ring a bell to anybody? Roy McMillan and later Veda Pinson. My favorite was a third baseman for the Cincinnati Reds, and I doubt whether anybody will know his name, Ray Jablonski. Does anybody know Ray Jablonski? Oh dear. Well, I named my dog after Ray Jablonski. My dog was Jabbo after Ray Jablonski. I gave that honor to my hero, Ray Jablonski. People were bigger than life to me when I was a boy growing up. I looked up to Willie Mays. I used to love to go to the ballpark and watch Willie Mays warm up, not with another center fielder, but he would warm up with somebody all the way on the infield. What a tremendous arm he had. I loved to go see Sandy Koufax pitch. I mean, he could really pitch. And I looked up to them, and I said to myself, when I grow up, I want to be just like him. As a little boy, I was looking up to these men, and I said, when I grow up, I want to be just like him. Now, one such player, and this player is a little bit before my time. I was only 6 years old when he stopped playing baseball. But a player that I see and have heard interviews about and have seen news clips about him that kind of summarize all of these heroes I had when I was growing up is the Yankee Clipper Joe DiMaggio. Here's some stats about Joe DiMaggio. He played 13 years from 1936 to 1951, interrupted by World War II. He was a Yankee all of his life. He only wore the Yankee uniform. And so humble is this man. All the accomplishments that he has. When they asked him, I think it was this All-Star game, doing some interviews, what is the greatest honor you ever had? What is the greatest accomplishment you ever? You know what he said? To wear a Yankee uniform. He didn't say who I am, what I have accomplished, the home runs I've hit, the great plays I've made, to wear a Yankee uniform. He was in 10 World Series games. In 1955, he was inducted into the Hall of Fame. And Chair truly was a gentleman on the field and off the field. And the only display of anger or disappointment, and I'm sure you have seen this, as he kicked the ground with his foot when he was going around second base when the outfielder caught his ball. A tremendous play. I mean, he was going to really make the play, and that was the only demonstration of his anger. And the lesson that I had as a boy growing up, and I heard this from one coach after another, Wendell, it is not winning or losing, but how you play the game. Now, don't get me wrong, I hated to lose. I had problems with losing. I would pout when I didn't win. I wouldn't talk to anybody if I didn't pitch a good game. But over and over again, it was drilled into me that the true ball player, no matter how terrible he plays, walks across the diamond and shakes the hand of the opponent and says, good job, you were the best man for the game that day. Winning or losing, but how you played the game. How does that fare today? How does that fare today? The idiom today is winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. When I think of Joe DiMaggio and all of the athletes and all of the heroes I had as a boy growing up, and I do not look back with rose-colored glasses. I am a realist. And I'm not painting some sentimental picture back there. I understand these men had their faults and they had their weaknesses. I understand that. But when you look back as a whole, and you see people like Joe DiMaggio and the other heroes for a little boy in those days, and you compare them with the athletes today whose language is so filthy, they are now setting guidelines for putting microphones in the dugouts, whose language is so filthy and explosive, you can read their lips after they do not make a play or they're upset with the umpire. When I think of Joe DiMaggio and I think of athletes today who are so uncontrollable in their anger that they take baseball bats and beat in the water cooler because they have struck out. When I think of players like Joe DiMaggio and I think of players today, their off-field activities we're told are going to have to change today because of this revelation of Joe DiMaggio. I say to myself, as the songwriter has already said, where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio? When I was thinking of this message, I thought how far we have come. I remember as a boy how people like Joe DiMaggio would advise kids who flocked around him to drink their milk so they could grow up and be big and strong. And now we're having people like Magic Johnson advising kids how to put on condoms so they won't get AIDS. And my friends, we have come a long way. I've got in my notes here, we have fallen a long way. Now this week, the word hero has been thrown around quite loosely. And we're all saddened anytime anybody is stricken with any disease, and especially AIDS, because it is a hideous disease. But Magic Johnson has been called a hero this week. And I think even the president referred to him as a hero this week. And I'm sure Magic Johnson wouldn't care what I say, but wouldn't listen to what I say, or wouldn't be impressed that I said it. But if Magic Johnson was here today, I would say to him, Magic, what would have been heroic is that you would have stepped forward before you got AIDS, and you would have told the youth of this nation that you are denouncing the promiscuous lifestyle that you have, and you're advising them to do the same. To me, that's heroic. To me, there is nothing heroic. Matter of fact, it's just sharing something which is going to be shared anyway, that you have now AIDS, and telling the kids that the only mistake you made was not the lifestyle you led, but because you did it without protecting yourself and having safe sex. Magic, if you tell the kids today that the most important error that you made is that you didn't practice safe sex, it's like throwing a rock to someone who is drowning in the water. That there's nothing heroic in what you are doing today, because the problem is not being unprotected. The problem is the promiscuous lifestyle that you and other heroes our kids look up to are living. I was thinking about this week. Have you ever put a bumper sticker on your car? I never have. And I said I never would. I enjoy reading them on other cars. But I said, I just won't do that. Well, I'm going to put a bumper sticker on my car for the first time. I was out the other day, and I was running. And when I run, I guess all this oxygen gets to my brain, and I think a lot better. But I came up with this slogan, and we've ordered 1,000 of these bumper stickers, so I don't have a place for 1,000 of these bumper stickers on my car. And the bumper stickers are going to say this: kids, there's no magic to it. Just say no to sex. Kids, there's no magic to it. Just say no to sex. If we can conduct a drug campaign by saying just say no to drugs, surely we can conduct a campaign that says just say no to sex. And I know, my friends, believe me, I know it's far more complicated than just that. But that is the beginning, I think, of getting the message out. Because the message today, and you and I know it, is safe sex. And that is not the problem. The problem is promiscuous sex. When you turn on the television, you see one benefit after another of Hollywood people, the stars of Hollywood, having one benefit after another to raise money for AIDS. And yet it's these same stars who star in movies where casual sex is the storyline. And then we had another basketball player who put out a book. He's mentioned by Magic Johnson here. And he says in this book that he has had sex with over 20,000 women in his life. Someone figured that out. That's like 1.3 women per day, 365 days a year, since he was 15 years of age. Now, whether that is just boasting, you know, and I would have to imagine there's a lot of embellishment in that story. But still, it's purporting to our kids, I mean, he had 20,000, surely just one or two is not going to be bad for me. Now, you see, the message in our society today is not stop doing it to our kids. The message today is protect yourself while you're doing it. And the assumption that this is made on is, well, they're going to do it anyway. And my friends, I am not prepared to give over that assumption, especially for my kids. Now, I know that my three kids are just as susceptible to all of the sexual pressure as any kids in this country. I realize that. But I am not going to assume, and I am not going to gather my kids around the way we're doing on television today and show them how to put on a condom and assume that they are going to have sex anyway. I am not going to make that assumption. The second reason I have a problem with this is that we could say, well, there's going to be bank robbers, so let's make sure that the bank robbers have protective bulletproof vests so they don't get hurt. It's a faulty assumption, my friends, but it's an assumption that this message of safe sex is based on. Well, they're going to do it anyway, so let's make sure that they are protected. Sex has been around, my friends, since Adam and Eve. And if anybody wants to know that, come to our Bible study on Wednesday night and we'll talk about that. But you know, my friends, it seems like sex has just been discovered in our lifetime, doesn't it? And we adopted new rules in the 1960s, and that was the time of the sexual revolution. And this is one of the basic tenets of humanism, is hedonism. This is humanism, my friends. Humanism says, you like something, go ahead and do it. That's the basis of humanism. If you like something, go ahead and do it. And I'd like to reflect just for a moment on the scorecard of humanism in the sexual revolution, all right? Now, we're living with the fruits of the sexual revolution that was spawned back in the 60s. And back in the 60s, I was a younger man, you won't give me that, will you? But I was a younger man. Sexual revolution, what's the scorecard? Today, venereal disease has never been as high and widespread as it is today. Syphilis, gonorrhea, herpes, warts, and so on. Now they're not even responding to treatment. 38 million abortions in the United States since Roe v. versus Wade, and this is the age of the birth control pill. Isn't that amazing? As if we didn't have a birth control pill. 38 million abortions in the United States. There is a multi-billion dollar porn industry, and it's growing bigger and bigger. Divorce and adultery is rising. When I was began my pastorate, and 10 people would come to me to get married, if any of them were living together, they would never tell me. I mean, never tell me. And I would guesstimate at that time maybe a half of one couple. How could that be? But over average, maybe one out of 10 were living together before they got married. Today, I would estimate that maybe four are living together before they get married. AIDS today is 100% fatal, and it's 100% preventable. And yet, it is increasing at an alarming rate worldwide. Now, my friends, you know that evil is like being bald. Do you understand that? Evil is like going bald. Now, when you go bald, you kind of lose a few hairs at a time, don't you? And you really don't notice it until you go and you meet somebody who hasn't seen you for a long while, like I did last week, and he says, "Boy, you've really lost the hair." I thought, when did this happen that I've done this? A little bit at a time, a little bit at a time, and you don't realize it. And that's the way evil works. What we tolerate today on radio and television, my. 30 years ago, we couldn't say the word pregnant and toilet on television, right? I think I was being a little prudish. I don't see anything wrong with that. I could tell you when I went into the ministry, I would have never mentioned the word condom in a message. I'll tell you that. But little by little, my friends, things are changing, and it's reflected in TV and radio and the shows that we watch. And my friends, I am not a prude, but I know vulgarity when I see it and when I hear it. And it's been inching its way little by little, and we have been kind of become used to it and hardened to it, and we're accepting more and more. Fewer and fewer things shock us. And every time, my friends, that I preach a message like this, or I think about this, which is often, I think of that great passage in Jeremiah that we are losing our ability to blush. That things don't embarrass us as they used to. The things are not offensive to us as they used to. The things that were once considered vulgar and filthy are maybe a little more acceptable today. And my friends, I think as a society, the same way back when Jeremiah was talking to the Israelites, that perhaps we are losing our ability to blush. And when we lose our ability to blush, then we put up with just a little more and a little more and a little more. Now, the question I ask you today, as a theologian, and I want to put this in theological concept, why does sex command so much intense feeling? You ever thought about that? Why are sex-related issues like abortion and pornography and AIDS so volatile? Why, when Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill were before the Senate Ethics Committee, why did they have ratings and people watching them like no other show in television history? Why? Well, my friends, in a theological concept, I believe that sex is the battleground of the great spiritual warfare that is going on today. Now, just think of that. Sex is the great battlefield of the great spiritual war that's going on today. And if you don't believe in a spiritual war, then just turn me off right now, because I really do. When I look around and I see the good that's happening in the world, and I see the evil happening in the world, I know there is a tremendous conflict going on between the forces of good and the forces of evil. If you believe in the Bible at all, you'll know from the very first chapter to the very end chapter, it speaks of this great battle that's going on. Why is sex at the very point of this great battle? It's very simple. Look up the book of John. John chapter 1, verse 4. It is said of Jesus, "In him was life, and the life was the light of men." John 5:26, "For as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son also to have life in himself." John 6:35, Jesus said, "I am the bread of life." John 11:25, he says, "I am the resurrection and the life." John 14:6, he says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." Jesus is life. As the Bible says, God is love, God is life. Sex is the doorway of life. Sex hovers around. It is all around. It hovers at the doorway of life. And this is why God so carefully guards it, and this is why the Bible so carefully regulates it. Because, my friends, if sex can become perverted, then it does not produce life. It destroys life. And I think, my friends, that is the reason why it is so intense. And that is the reason why I think the abortion issue is so volatile. That is the reason why I think the pornography in this country is flourishing. That is why I think so much perversion is going on, because that is the battleground. Here we have God, and he says he is life, and sex is the entrance to that life here on earth, procreating with God, and the evil of the world is trying to pervert that sex so it does not produce life, but it destroys life. You understand that? And this is why sex-related issues are so intense, because it is the very place where the forces of life and the forces of death are raging. Jesus didn't say, I know life. Jesus didn't say, you know, that I'm going to talk to you about life. Do you understand? He says, I am life. It's one of the great I am passages in the Gospel of John. There are seven of them, and two of them, I am the resurrection and the life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. Now, my friend, sex to Christians is a wonderful thing. And I know someone who is in a battle against pornography. And he says, you know, I have a hard time seeing that filth and that disgust and then going home to my wife and making love. Because you get around that and it's filthy and it's trashy. But I think we have to hold on as Christians that God has given this as a wonderful thing, and its proper place, it is a beautiful thing. But we know as God's people that sex is more than a feeling. It is more than a place to get power and prestige. Sex has a tremendous responsibility given to us. We have been given the very means to enter into life. We have been yoked with God in procreation. And the evil one knows that, and the evil one is out to destroy that, whatever means are possible. Now, if a humanist was sitting right out there, in that empty space, right over there, was sitting right over there, Duck Esther, right over there, the humanist would get up here today. Now, when I was a young man, I thought of myself as being a humanistic Christian. And that is, I had a great respect for man as God has created him. But then I started reading the Humanistic Manifesto, and I started understanding the humanistic side, and it's the complete opposite side of believers. If the humanist was here today, and he had a right to come, and I'm not trying to make a straw man up here, but if he had a right to come and refute what I was saying, here's what he would say. You all really don't believe that supernatural stuff, do you, about life? There's a spiritual warfare. You don't really believe these things that Jesus said. Hey, all we know is what we see. How we got here, nobody knows. You only got 70 years, basically, of life, so enjoy it. Indulge yourself. If you like it, if it feels good, then do it. Be safe. Not for any moralistic reasons, but so you can enjoy it that much longer. My friends, that is the message in a very subtle way that's being broadcast, being transmitted, and being proclaimed. And I think God's people need to challenge that message. You know, it may be only in your individual lives, it may be only in your offices, it may be only in your schools, wherever you are, that message has to be challenged. Do you believe that? Are you with me this morning? There is a movie called Field of Dreams, and I'm kind of wackos for baseball movies. I like The Natural, I like The Field of Dreams. I wish they'd get this language out of the films. I mean, it's such great films, they have to put a word in there, and it just ruins the whole movie. This is a movie about a man named Ray Canseco, and he thinks he's going past his prime at 36. Ray Canseco builds a baseball field. How many have seen The Field of Dreams? Oh, okay. For those of you who haven't, Ray Canseco builds a baseball field in the middle of an Iowa cornfield with the hope that ballplayers of yesterday will come back and play on this field. He doesn't know quite why he's doing it. In the end, there's a beautiful reason. And these ballplayers do come back. Mysteriously, they walk out of the corn and come onto the field. They ask him if this is heaven, and he says, no, this is Iowa. In the end, he's reunited with his deceased father, and on a beautiful, sunlit evening sky, they play catch together. And I wonder if any man could watch that without welling up and feeling the emotion there of the son and father who were estranged in life, and they come back together and they out there and catch. I know my father did not play baseball, but I think he'd play catch with me if I could go back and do that. So he's threatened with losing his farm and being pressured to sell the farm, thus having the baseball field destroyed. A character, a famous writer named Terrence Mann in the movie, advises him with these words. Ray, people will come, Ray. People will come to Iowa for reasons they can't even fathom. They'll turn up your driveway not knowing for sure why they are doing it. They'll arrive at your doorstep as innocent as children longing for the past. Of course, we won't mind if you look around, you'll say, only $20 per person. They'll pass it over, Ray, not thinking about it, because it's money they have. It's peace they lack. They'll walk out to the bleachers and they'll sit in their shirt sleeves on a perfect afternoon. They'll find they have reserved seats somewhere down on the baseline where they sat when they were children and cheered their heroes, and they'll watch the game like they have been dipped into magic waters. Memories so thick they'll have to brush them away from their faces. People will come, Ray, people will come. One constant to all the years has been baseball. America has rolled by like an army of steamrollers, erased like a blackboard, rebuilt and erased again. But baseball has marked the time. This field, this game, it's a part of the past, Ray. It reminds us of all that once was good and can be again. People will come, Ray. People will most definitely come. And so the question I leave with you today and with me also is, will the people come? Will God's good folks put aside the things which preoccupy them and proclaim the things today which once were good and make that old message new again? And the message goes something like this. Oh, yes, there is a God. And there are rules for living his life. And when the rules are broken, it means death in one way or the other. But when the rules are kept, then there's life and his name. Oh, where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio?